bunch of gamers, one channel, and tons of games. This must be Games and Me. This is the Pixel and Polygon Protection Group, and we are back for another ear-biting episode. I can't really figure out like what I was going to say there, but of course, this is Alex, and we have Magus here. What's been going on, dude?
Just chilling like I can because I feel like it.
Awesome. Yeah, I have been... Man, there's been so many good games that have been coming out. And it's funny because I feel that, you know, most of these are, you know, I don't know about you, dude, but most of the games that I've been playing lately are downloadable. So, you agree with this? I mean, what have you been playing nowadays?
It's been half and half. Oh, what have I been playing? For the third week in a row, repetition ensues. Because of the sheer fact that I am still playing Mario 64. I did play Gears of War 2, and I did complete it. And I will say this. It has the most pathetic final boss battle ever. Now, that doesn't mean the game is bad. It is an excellent game. Gears of War is one of my favorite franchises. But the final boss is beyond pathetic.
Yeah, it certainly does not compare to the last boss in Gears of War 1. And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, up in the air as to why Cliff Bleszinski decided that, you know, he should give you a break. You know, for the last battle in the entire game, I'm like, okay, really? Really now?
Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I mean, really, like, what I was going to say was just like, oh, well, you know, it's like, really? Like, okay, we've had all these, like, badass, like, you know, set pieces and stuff where we're fighting, like, on a raft and stuff, and we're fighting, like, you know, inside, like, you know, like, some insect and all that, like, huge insect, and then suddenly, like, a very... almost scripted battle in the end, which is just not flattering at all.
You're giving it more credit than it deserves, Alex, because you know why, how bad it was for me. I don't know if this was just me, but we were trying to shoot it and we never got a hit with the hammer of dawn. It didn't go off, and all of a sudden the game froze. And we didn't know why the game froze, and then like a second later we got like a bunch of achievements popped up and we didn't even do anything. That's how bad it was. I'm serious. That whole game is amazing, except you get to this boss battle, you don't even know you fucking beat it.
Wow. I don't recall having that experience. I know I was playing it with a buddy of mine, and I had to force myself to play through this. I mean, I don't know. Like, to me, like, the appeal of Gears of War in the series in general is the co-op play. That is something I love about the series. And, you know, when my friend left me in the middle of 5-1, I was like, I don't want to play this anymore. And, of course, when I got to the last level, I was just kind of like, it's kind of the same feeling I had with Resident Evil 5. It's like, I did not want to play through it because, like, you know, unless I find somebody who wants to play it with me, I'm not gonna do it type of deal, you know?
Right. Yeah. I see what you're saying. You know what, though? I agree completely on that because Gears of War is a co-op game and I can't play it any other way. I'm not saying it's a bad game. The game series is one of the best that have come out this generation.
Yeah.
One of the best new franchises, without a doubt.
Agreed, yeah.
Agree. It is amazing. It's still fun on single player, but it's not as fun with co-op, and I will always play it with co-op.
Yeah, I think, you know, whenever Gears of War 3 comes out, and I'm pretty sure it's going to come out, and, you know, you heard it here. It's not like this is going to be this is like some big secret that Gears of War 3 is going to come out. You know, I'm definitely going to play it co-op. I'm not going to play it, like, single player. I'm going to, like, basically call my friends, you know, maybe, like, you know, like, play co-op with you, Magus, and be like, hey, you want to do co-op? And be like, all right, let's do it, you know. No other
Hell
way.
Yes.
No other way to play this. So,
other way.
Yeah. Anything else you're playing, man?
Devil Survivor.
Oh, wow. Week 3?
That game is... You know what? I'm going to go on the limb and say it's becoming one of my favorite games of the year.
Wow.
It's that damn good. I love everything about it. I love the concept that it's a very easy game to learn, but it's a very hard and difficult, challenging game to master, in the same sense that it's like goddamn fucking checkers. It's easy to learn, but difficult to master.
Yeah.
And it's just so cool. Everything about it, I'm enjoying. This game has blown me away. It's so great, and I'm so glad I could take it wherever the hell I want, you know?
Yeah, especially for a strategy RPG, it's very difficult to find time to actually sit down and play a strategy RPG if it's locked down on your console. But in this particular case, you can take it wherever, you know, you can take it to the park, you can take it at a grocery, you can take it in places that you wouldn't normally take your video game consoles, if you know what I mean.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
You could take it to the library and play the motherfucker if you want, or you know what's funny is a lot of developers are realizing it, so a lot of console SRPGs are coming to handhelds, particularly Disgaea and Final Fantasy Tactics, and it seems like they're sticking to handhelds and they work perfect on a handheld.
And just recently announced too, Valkyria Chronicles 2 was announced for the PSP. And that's, you know, a pretty popular SRPG that started on the PS3, you know? That's just great.
Suffers from Dragon Quest syndrome.
Yeah,
Dragon Quest 9 is on the DS, 10 will be on the Wii, and watch, like, Dragon Quest 11 be on the PlayStation 3, and then 12 be on the 360 or whatever, so...
Well, this is not necessarily a bad thing, though, isn't it?
No.
Because, you know, we're talking about games that would generally take you about 40 or 50 hours to kind of finish, you know. If given the opportunity to be able to finish it a little bit faster, like, let's say, you know, I go to work, right? And you know, like, at lunchtime, I got about an hour to kill, you know? Like, you know, I just pop in, like, you know, my favorite, like, RPG or SRPG, and, you know, guess what? Like, if I want to continue it, I go home and then continue it again. If not, I just close my DS or put my PSP on standby mode, boom, you know? And I think Square Enix realized this by putting Dragon Quest IX on the DS. I personally don't think that the move for Dragon Quest X to be on the Wii is necessarily a good one, just because of the nature of those types of games. I mean, Dragon Quest tends to be a very, very long game, if you know what I mean. And I don't know, like, I think RPGs will suddenly find their niche in the handhelds, like, even more so over the next few years, because people are now discovering that that's the most optimal platform for something like that that's really, really long, you know what I mean?
They still work on consoles, I think. I really do, but they're really cool for handhelds. And I want to add the fact that Square Enix, one of the most brilliant things they have done, and maybe not just them, maybe they're not the ones who discovered it, but they have put one of the most convenient fucking features in an RPG, and that's the quick fucking save. Quick save.
Mm-hmm.
The quick save feature is so ideal for a handheld RPG. I mean, you could go to the doctor's office, play the RPG for 15 minutes, and quick save it and not worry about any save points or any of that bullshit.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and going back to Devil Survivor, you can suspend your battle and it'll act as an additional save slot, you know, in your game. And unlike the quick saves in Square Enix games, these suspend game slots do not delete themselves after you load them, which is awesome. So basically, you technically have two save slots. So you have one save slot for the battles while you're in the battles, and then the other save slot for where you're just mucking around exploring the city, which is absolutely fantastic. And check this out. Another thing that I love about Devil Survivor system, and might as well go into it because I have been playing it also, is the fact that every single battle, well, so far that I've fought, you can escape from real easily if you wanted to. You just basically pick it, you know. If you didn't want to suspend that battle, if you think that, oh, you're losing the battle and stuff, you can pick the escape, the retreat option. Boom, you're back into the map. No penalty.
That is the way to go for RPGs.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way to do it. Atlas is becoming a company that I have high respect for, and it's unfortunate that the mainstream media is not recognizing them as much as they should.
Mm-hmm.
Atlas America and Atlas in Japan, for what they're doing with stuff like it, you know, evolving the quick save feature,
mm-hmm.
is just pure fucking genius.
Yeah. I honestly, like, if, you know, if Final Fantasy 13 pops up with, like, with, you know, because, you know, I obviously we don't have the game right now, but if Final Fantasy 13 doesn't have, like, a option to be able to let you save anywhere, I don't know what I'm going to do. Because I think that if they want to make RPGs accessible, they only need to do one thing and one thing alone. Let us save anywhere. That's all you got to do. And allow us to save in multiple slots in case that we totally mess up and, you know, we can't do anything about it. Because, you know, don't you feel sometimes like those save points are a little bit too artificial in some ways, you know?
Save points have never bothered me. But they're not for everyone, though.
Right.
They're not for everyone. You know, the wrong way to do a save point, too, is the way Resident Evil did, to have an item required to save the fucking game. Ink.
Yeah.
Those ink things. But, on the other hand, though, I really do not mind save points. I'm used to them. They're conventional. But again, like you said, they're not for everyone.
Yeah.
Look at one of the most hardest core fucking RPGs out there. Lunar, Silver Star Story Complete. You can save that motherfucker anywhere you want.
Mm-hmm.
You can save that game at any point in the game. There's no save points, but it's one of the more challenging RPGs, which is interesting.
Right.
And it's on the PlayStation era, and if I remember correctly, you could do the same in the Sega CD version.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which is in a much older time of gaming than even the PlayStation.
Yeah. I mean, really, like, what I'm trying to say here is this. You know, for a society like, you know, in the United States, we tend to do a lot of things, like, you know, like, different things at the same time, as an example. And, you know, we only have X number of hours in a day. If you spend about 2 hours just trying to find a save point, or being, you know, or being too busy just doing that, like, you're basically, like, saying, like, oh, well, I don't really have... Like, you know, how often have you heard this? Like, oh, I don't have enough time for this RPG. I don't have enough time to finish this. So I think what they're really trying to say is, I don't want to keep, you know, searching for a save point and not being able to, you know, like, resume, like, where I left off, exactly where I left off. Because really what it forces you to do is, like, let's say they put a save point at the beginning of the dungeon and then a save point at the end of the dungeon. What really people mean is, like, well, I don't want to go back all the way back to the beginning of the dungeon, save there, redo everything again, and then go back to the beginning, resave again, you know, rinse, repeat, etc. Which, you know, but we've exhausted too much of this. Have you actually downloaded this new Monkey Island game on Xbox Live? It's about $10, dude.
Nope, I have not downloaded. I'm going to actually just save my points for Marvel vs. Capcom 2.
Aww.
I want to, you know, use some cable love on some poor unfortunate fools.
Yeah, I actually got the Secret of Monkey Island Special Edition, and I'll tell you what, that for $10, that game has a lot of love behind it. And the reason why I say that is because they could have just easily ported this over, like all the other games that, you know, on Xbox Live, like, you know, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles arcade game, you know, all these really, really old games. But they actually went one step ahead of what everybody is doing. So not only did they port the original game on there, but they also overlaid a new engine on top of that game. So that, check this out, Magus, this is what you can do in the game on the fly, on any cutscene, on any part of the game. You can hit the back button and switch from the new version of the game to the old version of the game on the fly. So, you know, you can, if you want to enjoy, like, the new, you know, artwork and then the voice acting and all that stuff, you can do that. If you want to enjoy the old school, you know, point and click adventure, you could do that as well. And again, you just, I tried it last night. I kept mashing the back button, and it was just switching back and forth. And I was like, wow, this is freaking amazing. This is absolutely Fantastic. And of course the jokes are still there and all that stuff, but you know, it's the feeling of, you know, kind of like when Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo HD Remix came out. It was like such so gorgeous and stuff, but you know, they only retained some of the elements of the original game to it, so you can't really play it as the old game. And imagine if you were able to do that in Street Fighter Turbo, Super Street Fighter Turbo, that'd be crazy, you know. So that's, yeah.
Just switch out to old Ryu sprites in the middle of a battle.
Yeah, it'd be cool. And you know, having all the contact points still work, you know. That's kind of like really what they did with Monkey Island. And I'm hope and they said LucasArts did hint that they have more announcements at this year's Comic-Con, and that is gonna be crazy. And kudos to them. I mean, I'm still getting Marvel vs. Capcom 2 at the end of the month. I already have that budgeted in. I just like opened up like my whole spread. I actually started a spreadsheet because I mean, I don't want to take up too much time for, you know, what you've been playing, but I discovered that I had 17 games pre-ordered. One game is $250. One game is, you know, $150, and two games are about $120. You guys probably know what the hell these games are. So, and I was like, oh man, am I gonna be able to afford this? And you know, of course, my spreadsheet finally said yes, and I'm like, yes, I can afford all these games. And but yeah, it's becoming very difficult for me to try to find time to play all these. So I gotta get cracking on some of these, man. You know, so
Wouldn't Beatles Rock Band happen to be the $250 one?
that's the only one. So
That's what I thought.
I already have my plastic instruments, but I want the limited edition stuff. So sorry, I'm still gonna get it, and I'm pretty sure the Dreamscapes are gonna be much worth it. And I'm curious to see how they're gonna really, you know, like pay homage to, you know, the Beatles with this game. Because again, speaking of a lot of love, like the Beatles Rock Band game has a lot of love and respect for the Beatles and, you know, the band itself. So definitely looking forward to that. And of course, $150 Prestige Edition, Call of Duty, Modern Warfare 2. I am getting the night vision goggles, yes. And the $220 games, Tony Hawk Ride, yes, we're gonna try it. And DJ Hero. So you can imagine the crazy unboxings that are gonna happen, you know, throughout the year, you know. That's gonna be like, oh my God, you got night vision goggles, a skateboard, and a DJ machine. Imagine like mixing all those together. Gonna be silly.
I thought the days when you came in little cardboard boxes with little NES cartridges were epic. Now you got big old fucking boxes the size of a console now.
Yeah, and you know, like, well, even bigger, because of course, you know, Beatles Rock Band is a big ass box. You know, and of course, you know, the Prestige Edition, you can now have your very own Soap McTavish bust.
Yes! What I've always wanted. Although we don't know what the fuck he looks like. Or at least I don't anyway.
I know. You never saw him. He never see looks at himself in the mirror, so I'm like, what? But you know, allegedly the night vision goggles was made so you can put it around the bus too. Like, where am I gonna put that? Let's be
Can
honest.
we? I want to use them.
I know. I think you expressed your desire to use the night vision goggles.
Chase cats.
Just creep them out at night.
Metal Gear Solid Cat, that would be my game. I would make it.
That's awesome. All right, so let's take a quick break and then we'll come back with maybe a rant, maybe a news article, who knows? So stick around. Sometimes scholarly, oftentimes juvenile, Twee Games strives to keep you up to date on the latest video gaming news from all the angles. Or maybe just make a bunch of dumb puns about DRM. Either way, it's worth a listen. So check us out on iTunes or on our website at www.gamesand.me. All right, and we're back. So we actually got like a couple of responses from last week's DPPPG episode entitled A Whole New Arc. And in that episode, we talked about video game morality. So, Magus, you want to go over through and, you know, kind of read some of these and probably respond to them and stuff?
Of course, I'll be happy to do that. And let's start with Bolto first.
Okay.
So let's see what Bolto has to say. I really don't care too much about morality in games, Bolto says, because honestly, most of the time it just seems really unlikely, like in Devil Survivor. As great as that game is, I don't think saying something would determine if someone is going to die or not. Like in Devil Survivor, as great as that game is, I don't think oh, and he's just repeating himself again, it looks like.
It
for
looks
some
like
reason.
He just pasted it twice or something. Okay. So I kind of, that's the thing that I was talking about last week, right? It's like, you know, like people, there is a morality in the game, but unless you have empathy towards the characters, like unless you care about those characters, you're not going to want to, you're not going to care about the morality in, you know, in the game at all, you know?
Exactly. And you know what? I do give a damn about the characters in Devil Survivor. So I completely disagree with Bolto on this.
Okay.
So I like Yuzo. I like Itsuro. I like Kaisuke. I like main character. Because
mm-hmm.
I am main character, goddammit. So I like him, obviously.
Yeah. That might also have something to do, perhaps, with the fact that you could, maybe people are not renaming the main characters themselves. So there's that disattachment right there, almost, you know? But I don't know. Again, it's possible that, you know, it might be that. It's possible that, you know, it's just their personal take on it. I think it's just like, you know, like how close can you connect with somebody, you know, like, you know, in terms of their situation. So maybe if, you know, maybe if he's not, I don't know, a 16-year-old, 17-year-old student in high school, maybe it's a little bit difficult for him to kind of go through that kind of thing. I don't know.
That's a very good point. And I want to also say that when you name your character, that's always interesting to me because I found out, and I want to talk about Persona for a brief second, Alex, about mm-hmm. the naming aspect sure. of this, is I found out that there are default names for the main characters in Persona 3 and 4.
Mm.
They're from the manga, and people are naming after the manga and saying, oh, that's the correct name, you got to name it. And I'm like, no, I don't need to do that. I didn't even know these names existed. So I named them like Anthony, and it was kind of funny because they called me Anthony-san during Persona 3.
Yeah.
It kind of cracked me up. But I think it's a connection to you when you name your character after yourself or whatever. It feels more like you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's always great. But as for Bolto's, he's, you know, that's fine. His taste seemed to be more caring about the gameplay aspects.
Right.
But for me, to me personally, I care about a lot about the overall package for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And if the point of a game is to question your morality and it executes it well, then that's great.
Mm-hmm.
If the point of a game is to rescue the fucking princess for the 13th time and the level design is great, who needs the morality in that case?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because they did what they fucking did.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you know, he brings up the point, saying something would, it's not just saying something, though. This is where I disagree with it. Because in playing Devil Survivor, he's not just saying stuff. He's making decisions,
mm-hmm.
you know? He is making actual decisions. Like, at the end of each day, you get emails and you decide to who you want to respond to.
Mm-hmm.
And the way you want to respond. And it's not just saying something. It's going to affect how that person reacts to you. Like, on some of the email responses, you could be completely rude or completely nice to that person.
Mm-hmm.
This is where I disagree. He's not just saying something. He's making a decision.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's ultimately happening. It's not just saying something. Do you not agree with that, Alex? I don't know.
Well, let's kind of flow this over to, like, the next comment that we have, because I think we'll be, you know, I don't want to rediscuss stuff that we've already discussed, so let's try to kind of apply it to our next comment. So do you want to read that too, dude?
All right. This one's a little bit lengthy, but it's from my good pal Shintai123. And he says, I have a complicated opinion of morality system in games. Morality systems usually serve a few purposes: replay value, connection with plot and characters, and possibly expand gameplay. Here's my issue with morality in games. The game usually plays up to being all about the choice you make during the game, but it usually amounts to very little compared to this one big decision at the end of the game. Like, say, Jade Empire, Fallout 3, or Fable. You can be an evil motherfucker in a Jade Empire, but at the very end decide to choose the good option, and it feels like there was no point in being the bad guy because the end result is mostly based on one decision, and not the many decisions made during the game. Now, I do like the content behind it, play the same game, but with a different feel to it in order to keep it fresh. That's fine, but a lot of the time the execution is lacking. Another thing is these games almost never have any benefits in being neutral, which can almost be harder to do. Ooh, it's easy to be the good guy, it's easy to be the bad guy, but not easy to balance the two, and there are no rewards for it in any way. You only get such and such spell if you're good evil. There's no moderation. Lastly, it may sound like I'm ragging on the idea in general, but I am not. I simply want this idea to be integrated because so far I haven't played a game that got it right. Now, I haven't beaten Knights of the Old Republic yet, so this game might be different, but until then, morality systems have been a good idea with meh execution, and I, of course, disagree with some of that.
Mm-hmm.
The part I do disagree with is that there has been games that have done it right, and the game that has done it right is Mass Effect. Because Mass Effect did not have a big choice that defines you. You made all these little choices throughout the game that somehow affected you. Examples, whether you wanted to kill that Bug Queen, remember that part? Or not.
Right.
That affected certain aspects of the game, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
The, you know, who you choose as your romantic interests, which will affect the sequel, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. The confrontation with Rex.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the ending. But if you choose the ending, it has no bearing in the other choices. The game did it right in that sense because you made all these little choices that are ultimately going to affect. Also, the, what's his name? Kaido? The Kaido and Ashley decision, too. That's another choice. The ending choice does not, you know, reverse all the previous choices. You all have repercussions from all these smaller choices you made. So Mass Effect did it correctly, in my humble opinion.
Well, I agree with everything that you said up until the last part. I think what Shintai is trying to say is this. The thing is that it doesn't, this kind of tied in with my personal feeling as to what happened with Bioshock 2, which kind of took me out of the experience altogether. Remember when I was telling you last week that, okay, well, Atlas just totally fucked you over. Now you're okay with just saying, you know, doing stuff that would basically conform to what he wants you to do, i.e. killing the little sisters. That doesn't seem right, you know, from a, you know, from even an evil person's perspective, you know. But as far as Mass Effect goes, so you have this, okay, so let's say you're very, very Paragon and all that stuff from the very entirety of the game. Sure. Ending comes, and this is going to be a spoiler. You decide to kill off the entire council. That's not within your character's personality. That's just you arbitrarily picking the, you know, okay, you just want to be different, I suppose. I think what we're seeing here is that people are wanting specific things about a game, but they're not. Again, I think this is really the problem, what I'm saying here. I think the real problem here is we're not seeing enough character empathy from X character to, you know, whatever's happening in the game. I think that's really what's happening here. Because if you feel that you are that person, like if you are Commander Shepard, you're not going to do what I just said and be Paragon and completely fuck over the entire council. No way. It's not within your character. You know, even if it does give you that option. At the same time, you can't take that option out. You can't take the whole option of not having that decision where you know, based off of what you did the entirety of your existence in the Mass Effect universe, this is the ending that you're going to be forced to, you know, we're going to force you to get. You get my drift?
I kind of do. I disagree with that too, though, because here's the thing about Mass Effect. Now, I see Shintai's point about Jade Empire. I remember that, you know? It was some, you had they, you know, the bad guys had some sort of what, water god captured or something. And
right.
Spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't beaten Jade Empire, which I'm sure not many left anymore. But you made all these good and evil choices, and then at the end of the game, you could either kill the dragon and take its power, or let release it and be good, right? And for some reason, this was just bad game design, was it would, you know, if you chose the good path, but you were evil the whole way, you would be automatically good. If you chose the evil path, the good path, but chose the evil decision, you'd be evil all the way. So that made no sense. I agree with Shintai on that. But what made Mass Effect interesting, this is why I'm going to rebuttal you, Alex, is for the sheer fact that it's not necessarily evil or good. Okay? It was, if I remember correctly, Renegade and Paragon, right?
Right.
To me, Renegade was just being a bit more assholeish, but not necessarily evil. You know, a bit more aggressive in the way you confronted people.
Ah, that's true.
Paragon was more of... Paragon was more of a, you know, by the books standard, if that makes
almost
sense.
Almost kind of like a, you know, Captain Kirk type of personality, I suppose.
Exactly. And the way I saw that game is there were times when you had to break the rules to do the right thing. You had to make vigilante-like decisions. But mind you, they were not necessarily evil. This is just how I looked at the game. They were not necessarily evil. Harsh, maybe, but not necessarily evil. And that's why I thought the game was brilliant. The whole council part, too, was more, you know, was more of a decision of did you want aliens or humans? It wasn't necessarily a question of Renegade or Paragon. It was more of a racist issue in my mind because that game had such a heavy emphasis on racism. I didn't see it as Paragon or Renegade. I saw it more as, you know, the aliens are kind of assholes to you. And admit they were. See, there was just a complex level of depth. It wasn't just merely good and evil. It was there, you know, there's all these underlying issues, you know. The aliens, you know, the council races look down on the humans as being lower than them. And I can see why one would make one decision, but why you would make the other to save them. It wasn't an evil decision. The way the game was portrayed was not evil. That's why I disagree. I think Mass Effect did it right.
Well, my point here is this. I think what he's trying to point out is that there is a disconnect between you as a personality versus the play, versus you being a character in the game. And I think that, I don't know if Shintai, you know, if I'm... you know, representing you right, but you don't, I don't think you normally name your characters the same name as you. So that, in that sense, the disconnection has already started. You're basically saying that this, you know, like as an example, Vanessa named her, you know, character in Mass Effect, Doofhead, you know, not the most normal name in the world, but she's already making that determination that, you know, Doofhead Shepherd is not her. Okay. So what I'm saying is basically like maybe that's where it starts. Maybe that's the whole point of the morality issue is that players sometimes don't want to be part of that universe. And sometimes that's why these morality choices don't work. And I personally believe that wholeheartedly because if you personally don't have any vested interest in the entire game and you just want to play through it just to beat it, I am fairly certain that you don't give a shit about what's going to happen in the game. Now, as far as Mass Effect goes, there's a lot of gray, there's a lot of gray areas in Mass Effect, and I definitely agree with you on that. But Mass Effect is different from all these other games that he's mentioned because there are ramifications in the future that does carry over. So, like, as an example, if you killed off the entire council, or maybe you killed Rex, or maybe you killed, you know, either Ashley or Kanan, then guess what? They're not going to be in the next fucking game or the game after that. You know what I mean? So it's a much harsher, you know, type of, you know, almost consequence, I suppose, if you will, than let's say, oh, well, I'm done with Knights of the Old Republic 1. I know that this is not going to affect me in Knights of the Old Republic 2. You get what I mean?
I see your point on that, but this is what I'm looking at. As good as those games, and if I remember correctly, Knights of the Old Republic had the same flaw that Jade Empire did. A decision that ultimately changed all your decisions.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I understand your connect with your, you know, the whole disconnect with the character, right?
Right.
I see that completely. I completely understand that. I'm just saying that for me, I got involved in all those games, though, nonetheless. And
right.
I wasn't trying to play it in a particular way. But the thing is I think you have to look at it a different perspective. I love role-playing. I've played D&D. I play Neverwinter Nights where you actually have to role-play. Okay? And I guess, you know, I understand the concept of it. And that's why I love the BioWare games and such, or Western RPGs, because you actually role-play. You know? And
right.
I still like JRPGs, don't get me wrong. But
right.
I like the whole aspect of role-playing. And that's what engages me into this whole fucking thing. Is, let's, you know what? We've talked about Mass Effect. Let's talk about Fallout 3, okay?
Okay.
Okay. The ending was shit. We all know that.
I think we all know that, yes.
The ending is complete utter trash. It is a slideshow with Ron Perlman's voice. Yippee fucking do for investing 30 hours in that mother, or however more. But there were some interesting moral choices in that fucking game. Let's take a look at the infamous Megaton choice at the beginning of the game, or whenever you play it, depending on whenever you visit it. The guy offers you a bunch of caps to blow up Megaton. Okay, you're going to kill a bunch of people, but you're in a harsh environment, so you need what you need to survive.
Right.
And that choice actually had ramifications. You destroyed a whole fucking town. And that town's no longer there, and I thought that was completely awesome. That's one of the most unique choices in an RPG I've seen. In that whole thing with Megaton, you blow up the motherfucker, the town's not there, you can't do anything in the town. And there's ramifications. Sure, you got a bunch of fucking caps for it, but you can't do the, you know, the survival guide quest or any of this.
This is why I don't think that some of the moral decisions on Fallout 3 actually works to the extent that they want it to. Other than the survival guide quest, there is absolutely no other quest there that you cannot finish, you know, without having any sort of, you know, doing it first, then blowing up the city. What happens to Moira, and this might be a spoiler, this is a spoiler-filled episode, mind you, is once you blow up Megaton, she shows up at, the name escapes me, but she becomes a ghoul, and she actually goes to the underworld, I think that's what it's called, and you can finish the survival guide there.
Mm. See, that's just gameplay design flaw, though, right there. Then,
because honestly, personally, like if you really, you know, if you really didn't care about any of those people, well, fuck you. We're gonna kill Moira. Also, you're not gonna get your survival guide done. Screw you. you know, that's personally how I do it. Because that way, you're like, oh shit, I forgot. I have like a quest for her. What am I gonna do now? You know, type of thing. It's a lot. The emotional factor would be a lot stronger. But you know, initially you know, obviously, as a person who played the game for the first time, who just popped it in back when it first came out, they're like, oh, shit, Moira just died. And, of course, they discover the underworld later on while they're playing, you know, and they're like, oh, my God, she's there, so I can still finish it. It's almost like the emotional impact of Megaton is just kind of alleviated a little bit because you're, like, saying, oh, thank God, I betrayed you, but you're actually still okay. you know what I mean?
I guess what it ultimately comes down to, though, in the end, is the player themselves. Because I actually kind of cared for Megaton. I spent a lot of time in Megaton in that game. I still do when I play it. And for the sheer reason is, to me, to my character, feels like it's home. You know, that's I felt connected to that world. I just did, to that game. And Megaton, I gave a damn about because that's became my character's home. You know, I know that sounds nuts because I got a house for saving him, and I had my little butler robot, and that's where I took my dog to and all that shit. And that was basically my character's fucking home. And it felt like that. And it was just the presentation of the game. I think it's just ultimately about the connections of the game. Yes, there are gameplay flaws in it, you know, like the choices in Jade Empire and the choices in Knights of the Old Republic. But I think BioWare did a better job in choices in Baldur's Gate 2, although there wasn't really any alternate ending until the expansion pack. But they did have some serious choices in that fucking game in Baldur's Gate 2. And I, you know, there was this one quest I remember in Baldur's Gate 2 where there's this paladin named Amonin or something, and he got pissed because the rival house of his or some shit got killed his sister. And you go, you can make the choice of talking him out of it or making him go, and he'll end up fucking killing the sister, and he'll lose his paladin status. The sister of the rival house, daughter of the rival house, in revenge for his sister dying. So he loses a lot of his powers, and that had ramifications. That character became somewhat useless, if I remember. I could be wrong about that, but I remember him losing his paladin class because he broke the rules of his class doing that. And that's a ramification right there.
Yeah. And, you know, the reason why I'm just kind of playing devil's advocate here for Magus is because I wanted to kind of, you know, give him a discussion and stuff. And I want to make sure, you know, he's obviously true to his word. And of course he is all the time. And, you know, I'm, as you guys have heard in the previous episode of this, you know, this podcast, I'm a pretty big supporter of role-playing games and stuff. And let's face it, I didn't get into, you know, the pen and paper RPGs and stuff or the dice rolls and whatnot. But I have to say that, you know, RPGs started for me as a as a video game form. And, you know, I've been actually doing, like, naming my characters as my friends or myself, like, pretty much over the past few years. And I think that kind of adds to just the personality of the characters and stuff. They're not just, oh, Celis or Locke or, you know, in Mass Effect's case, you know, Commander Shepard or in other of these RPGs. No, they're actually my friends. And when something bad happens to them, you know, something, you know, it hits a lot closer to home. Even seeing that name, even though I named Cloud as myself and I'm like this spiky haired blonde kid with a big ass sword, I still felt that, you know, like close to him when, you know, Eris finally died. Because, of course, at the time I named her after my crush and I was like, oh my God, killed so and so. And I'm like, okay, that's enough of that. I'm embarrassing myself here. So the moral of the story is, you know, let go and try to get a lot closer to your main character and their friends as much as you can, because you might discover something that, you know, might be truly magical there, because that's something that only video games will be able to offer you, you know. And I feel that people are kind of missing out by not being, you know, not letting themselves be that character, you know. So, all right. So let's take another quick break, and then let's go through maybe just one news article, and then let's go through the stupid elitist fanboy comment of the week. So stick around. On The Review Club, we review from a different angle than most. We prefer not to ask whether a game is good because, let's face it, there'll always be somebody out there who'll appreciate the subtle complexities of Super Noah's Ark 3D. Instead, our Review Club asks, who's this game good for? We're a diverse group, and we can always be counted on some lively conversations. So check us out on iTunes or on our website at www.gamesand.me. All right, and we're back. So we're apparently going to be talking about a news article today. So, Magus, what is this news article?
This news article is that one of the year's most anticipated games is no longer one of the year's most anticipated games, but one of 2010's most anticipated games. And that, of course, is BioShock 2, which has been delayed.
Oh, I'm actually pretty happy that it got delayed, but, you know, with my, you know, $1,500 worth of pre-orders, but go ahead.
All right. Well, back on the 13th, a couple days ago, 2K announced that the November 3rd launch of BioShock 2 has been postponed till mid-2010. And from what I understand, the reason for this was because they're not feeling that the game is up to par to what they think BioShock is. And that's understandable because BioShock is a title that's held in high esteem.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, to me, in my honest opinion, if they don't feel that the title is up to steam, they should delay it. Now, remember, want to talk a little bit about gaming history. This is not the first time something like this has happened. While I'm not saying this is the exact same thing, but remember when Resident Evil 2 was slated for 97 release?
Right.
And we saw, Leon Kennedy, and then that biker or racing chick, remember her?
Right.
And then they scrapped the whole game, and we got the game in its final form. They restarted the game from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
So what ultimately happens with situations like this, not saying they're scrapping BioShock 2 or anything, is we get a better game. And while I understand delays can be frustrating, this is not a bad delay. I'd rather wait longer for a great game than wait a few months for a mediocre game. So I honestly think that if they feel that the game is not on par and they admit that, that's the first step, and delaying it is the second step.
it's like going to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's like, first, you're admitting that you're an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
Second, you gotta put the steps so that you're no longer an alcoholic.
Unfortunately, Alex, though, here's the problem, dude.
All right.
A lot of developers tend to release half-assed games. Two Worlds, excuse me. Two Worlds. Yes, a game that I heard that got a lot better with a fucking patch, which should not have been released. Which should not have been released incomplete in the first place. Why the fuck did you wait to release a goddamn patch a few months after that fixed the game's problem, then release it at launch? Finish your fucking games. If you feel it's not on par, don't release it. Talk to your publisher. And if you're the publisher yourselves, then come on.
Well, not
delay
only
the fucking thing.
Not only that, get some people who can be in your focus groups that are competent in your fucking games. Don't pull, the Joe who has absolutely no idea what freaking BioShock is. Put them there and have them, try the game out. That's not the way to do it, I've been in a focus group before where they pulled us in a group and we're not the target demographic for said game, I'll come out here and say it because obviously that game doesn't exist anymore. It's The Sims Online. All of the guys in the freaking room were dudes. Like, their target demographic's females. And we told them outright, look, the economy is broken. Fix it immediately. And guess what they did? They didn't do it. So what happened? Sims Online turned into an online cyber sex economy. Because guess what? The fastest way to get money in The Sims Online is get a vibrator bed, jump in, do cyber sex there, and get 1,000 simoleons per. Who's going to work like hours on end grinding to get 60 simoleons for each of your fucking job mini games? Again, you have to listen. Sometimes there are moments where your fans are correct. And you just have to kind of, take a big gulp and, try to fix it. Now, here's another, let me give you two games that have done this before. Two games that have basically scrapped their game or pushed it back. BioShock 1. BioShock 1 was not up to par with what Ken Levine wanted. So guess what he did? He scrapped the entire project and they only had 8 months until they finished the game. And guess what? BioShock turned out the way it is right now, which is awesome. Now, here's a bad part of this. another game that got pushed back and turned out to be complete and utter shit. Tomb Raider, Angel of Darkness. That game got pushed in years, because it was going to be like a PlayStation 2 exclusive, and then they turned it to like a point-and-click adventure game. Not good.
No. Sometimes it's... Sometimes pushing back, and maybe the first build is better. It's, you know, it's like you said, that's a good example because it's both on both end of the spectrum, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I want to talk about a game that was scrapped, re-scrapped, scrapped, re-scrapped. And you know what game that was? And what? I'll be honest, it's not the most popular game. It's not, you know, it's a game I immensely enjoyed, though. And it was a very early release this generation of gaming. Summer 2006. Not much came out for the 360. This little game called Prey came out.
Oh.
And Prey has a very interesting history. It was considered the soul brother to Duke Nukem Forever, which will now finally never be released. But many people thought Prey was like this. Prey went through so many versions. So many fucking versions. I don't know. There was like four different versions before they got to the current version of the game that got ultimately released. And while it's not the best game in the world, it certainly was a very solid and very entertaining first-person shooter in its own right. And it had a very interesting story. And I have to say, I enjoyed Prey, and I think they did the right thing, you know? They re-scrapped the fucking game till they fucking got it right.
Right.
And maybe it's not, you know, it's not the groundbreaking game they wanted, but it turned out to be correct. And delaying, in conclusion, delaying Bioshock 2 is a smart move. And another game that's coming out, I believe, in August, Arkham Asylum, got delayed a couple months. But still, a couple months can make a big difference.
And even Ghostbusters also, like, that got pushed back. And, you know, it's a pretty solid game. A lot of people, like, dog on it because it's a licensed game. But it's actually a very solid, you know, like, in just movie-based game, which is great, you know. Sometimes a little push, you know, can do a lot for your game.
Exactly. It can really save a game. And Ghostbusters was one of the best movie-based games I've ever played.
Yep.
And it's just worth it, you know? And look, you know what? It's interesting. Look at Twilight Princess and Super Paper Mario, too. Those were both games that were pushed back. Remember Super Paper Mario and Twilight Princess, while it was released on the GameCube, both games were just meant for the GameCube.
Right.
And they ended up becoming on the Wii. Now, while Twilight Princess got both a version on the Wii and the GameCube, Super Paper Mario got a lot of, and I really enjoy Super Paper Mario, got a lot of unique gameplay elements with the Wiimote. So delaying a game and even switching its console is not necessarily a bad thing.
Right. But of course, as we demonstrated with both of our examples, it could also go bad. So, but again, I think you can encapsulate it real well. The first step is acknowledging that you have a problem, and the second step of it is doing something about the problem. And I think that Bioshock 2 is on its way to solving its problems, you know. So, all right. So that was a very serious discussion about games, as usual, but let's talk about the silliness that is fanboyism. So, Megus, who is the victim for this week's stupid elitist fanboy comment of the week?
201 Jake from IGN.
Ooh, uh-oh.
I went somewhere different for once. Instead of game facts is too easy. Game trailers is way too easy. It's a haven of PS3 fanboys for some reason. This guy decided to say, Nintendo DS sucks because of the graphics. PSP graphics win.
Wow.
PSP graphics win.
Ugh.
Yes, folks, the PSP is a very powerful handheld. There's no doubt about that. And it's a handheld I enjoy. But the DS may not have as much power, but there are some good-looking fucking games on that game, on that little handheld.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some very, very damn good fucking games on that handheld.
Yep.
So because something has better graphics does not mean it's fucking better. It's like that pretty girl that you have a crush on in high school, but she's a fucking complete dumbass when it comes to everything else. And that's just not interesting. But I'm not saying the PSP is bad, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like my PSP.
Oh, yeah, I agree, too. I hope for this guy, you're enjoying the well-rendered balls and, you know, in Mercury, you know, because that's so, you know, that's so needed, like the PSP's power and stuff. Sometimes, even if you do have a lot of graphical power, doesn't mean that people will take advantage of it. Let's make that clear, because there are those games that we've seen over the past few years that have proven that power is nothing unless you can make a good game. You get what I mean, dude?
Exactly.
Do you remember any games that were actually like that, that looked like utter shit, even though they were like on a next-gen platform? Then some of them escape me right now, so I can't really name any.
There's a couple games. There was Enchanted Arms. I actually despise that game in all aspects. There's that Gundam game that came out with the PS3 at launch. Remember that?
I think so, yeah.
That game looked like a PS2 game. There was also, this is a game I enjoy called The Outfit, but that game's ugly as fuck. I like it, though.
Yeah.
It's a very ugly game. I'm trying to think of anything else.
I think Mercenaries 2, people were saying that it looked like ass when it came out.
I never played Mercenaries 2, so I can't really say.
Yeah, this is a third party, reaction, so I can't really vouch for it myself.
It's unfortunate, though. Remember those ports of like Gun and stuff that came out with the PS, not the PS3,
oh,
the Xbox 360?
Yeah,
and they looked almost
that.
The same.
Yeah, yeah, I know that. Yeah,
yeah. So they make ports that don't look really that great. Even Bully didn't look that great of a port for the 360 compared to the PS2 version. I didn't think anyway.
Yeah. But, I mean, you get what I mean, though? It's like, you can have the most powerful console in the world, or a more powerful portable in the world, but that doesn't mean that everybody's going to take advantage of it. And, you know, sure, the DS is not, you know, the most graphically, you know, strongest powerhouse, but check this out. Remember, I don't know if you know this, dude, I'm just addressing this PSP fanboy here. There's this game that came out in Japan called Dragon Quest IX that sold about 2.34 million copies. If graphics really mattered, you know, this thing wouldn't sell for $60 a pop to 2.something odd million Japanese, you know? And mind you, a DS game that fucking costs $60 sold for 2 million copies.
Jesus Christ. That is fucking insane.
Mm-hmm.
How many... Dragon Quest is a fucking phenomenon in Japan.
Yeah.
That is insane. But you have good points, and... The DS games don't look ugly. I thought, you know, the Final Fantasy IV remake looked pretty nice. And that RPG, I forgot the name of it. The name escapes me at the moment. But it's from the same company that did the remakes of Final Fantasy IV and III.
Avalon Code?
No. It's something else.
Nostalgia. They're also making
that
one.
Yeah, Nostalgia. It looks good. I thought it looked good.
Not only that, they're also working on a brand new Final Fantasy called Final Fantasy Gaiden, The Four Warriors of Light, which looks absolutely fantastic.
I haven't seen anything on that, unfortunately.
Oh, I gotta link you after this, because you're gonna be like, oh my god, that looks fucking incredible.
There, you know what looked incredible on the DS2 was Zelda Phantom Hourglass. Looks really fucking good. It really carried the cartoony look from Wind Waker quite well.
And GTA Chinatown Wars, that's a badass game on the DS.
Oh yeah, that game looks very beautiful as well too. It looks very nice. So the DS does not look bad. I, you know, graphic horrors don't even care about gameplay, a lot of them, it seems. You know, they just like what looks nice.
Well, I think it's it's also propelled by, you know, they feel that, oh, there's so much power, therefore it's a lot better type thing. Let me give you this great example, okay? Back in the PS2 era, a lot of Xbox guys were like saying like, oh yeah, the PS2 sucks because look at Halo, it looks so much better. And of course, you got games like, you know, Shadow of the Colossus and stuff, and you know, like how it looked absolutely fantastic, and you can't find anything like that on the Xbox. So I'm you know, like kind of putting myself into that, you know, into that guy's shoes. I don't know if he actually felt that way about, you know, like, you know, Xbox owners at the time when he had a PS2. You know what I mean? It's like, it's kind of pathetic because it's like you want to side with whoever you want to be with, you know, and obviously, you know, this guy's probably also a Sony fanboy. So I wouldn't be too surprised if his, you know, if he's just kind of parroting what the Xbox guys did to him. You know, but except on a different, you know, type of platform, I guess.
PlayStation 3 is the most powerful console out there. And to be honest, I really don't know the specs. I really don't care about system specs. When I look at a console, I look at the games that interest me.
Right.
And I don't give a fuck about, you know, what has the biggest, fastest processor. Now, I'm not saying Xbox is better or PS3, but from what I've seen from the PS3, not knocking the PS3, it seems like a lot of people haven't, a lot of developers, aside from the guys who did Uncharted and Metal Gear Solid 4, and if you wish, Alex, any Killzone 2, haven't really took advantage of its graphical capabilities, aside from those guys.
Criterion. But, Criterion also. Burnout Paradise.
Burnout Paradise. But in all honesty, who gives a fuck? Who fucking cares? You know, I if I get a PS3 again, you know what I want to play too? Valkyria Chronicles. I want to play fucking Valkyria Chronicles 2. And I don't care what it fucking looks like. It's an SRPG. I want to play it on that sure fact. This Gaia 3. That game could be on a fucking any console out now.
Right.
And I still want to play that. There's just, it's the games that interest me. I don't care if Whatnot is, what I'm trying to say is I don't care if this console is more powerful or not, okay? Last gen, it was PS2 that had the games that interested me. And the Xbox had good games. That's why I got one. Some games that I was interested in. The GameCube had good games that were interesting me. But it was ultimately the PS2 that won out. This generation, in my honest opinion, this is just my opinion, it's the Xbox 360 for me. It has the games I'm interested in. Not power, just the games. So it's games to me, not fucking power.
I kind of echo that statement too, because as you guys may have surmised by mentioning the fact that I have a mere $1,500 worth of pre-orders, That's a set of pre-orders that, guess what, ranges a huge, huge, huge spectrum of consoles. You know, we're talking like, you know, the collector's edition of Batman Arkham Asylum for PS3, you know, Professor Layton Diabolic Box for the DS, Persona PSP, you know, Uncharted for PS3, you know, like, just, you know, Silent Hill, Shattered Memories for the Wii, Dante's Inferno for the Xbox 360, you know, a huge, huge variety of game consoles. And, you know, guess what, sometimes that's why I kind of feel sorry for fanboys and stuff, is because they're being so stubborn about all these games. And, you know, I'll be honest, like, not a lot of people can probably afford as many games as I can. But I'm not going around saying, like, declaring that any of them is better than the other. And I think that's, you know, there's a very few of us that can kind of be happy with what we're served with our life and just kind of, like, you know, and just take it for what it is, as opposed to having to defend it for some godforsaken reason. In closing, you know, make do with what you have. That's really, like, you know, that's what I had to do. I only had, like, the Super Nintendo. I didn't have the Saturn. I had to buy, like, my PlayStation when I was, like, working in a movie theater. Who cares if I can't afford everything else? I didn't make fun of other people for not having a PlayStation. Instead, you know, be an example. Tell them why you picked over that. don't make fun of their decision, because that's just, you know, that's just making it look like an asshole. That's all there is to it, really.
You can prefer a console. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yep.
But because you prefer doesn't make it better for everyone else. Like I exactly. said, I honestly will say I like my 360 the best out of all this generation. Mm-hmm. But that's my personal preference. If you think the PS3 is a better console and it's your preference, that is totally cool. I'm not going to go, "Oh, you suck, die, fanboy."
Yeah. And going back to the whole argument about like technology, you know what? Look, the PC, okay, PCs back in, you know, when the PlayStation era were like what? Like, you know, 700 megahertz, you know, 800 megahertz, a gigahertz and stuff. That didn't stop the PlayStation 3, which was at 33 megahertz to run fucking Tomb Raider. You know, okay? So, specs don't matter in console gaming specifically. And PCs, you can upgrade it however the hell you want, make it pretty. That's, you know, that's what PC gaming's for. You know, specs have no place in console gaming, period.
Exactly, Alex. And you know what? I still play games. That's why I think we retro game too, because we don't give a fuck how, you know, how big or how fucking, you know, what graphic bits Super Mario Brothers is. No one cares about that. Everyone universally agrees that game is one of the all-time greats of gaming. Super Mario Brothers. No one fucking cares about, oh, it's this many sprites, or, you know, the block had this many sprites making it up. No, who the fuck talks about that? No one.
No one, yeah.
No one. And who gives a fuck how many polygons makes up Marcus Fenix? Who gives the fuck how many polygons make up Kratos? Oh, Kratos has more polygon counts than Marcus Fenix. Who cares? We never cared about it for fucking Mario. We never cared about it for fucking Link or Sonic or any of the all classic game characters. No one cares about them.
Yep.
So why should it matter for modern characters? That's just dumb when they start arguing about polygon counts. And I've seen it happen. Oh, Kratos has more polygon counts than this person. And I'm like, does that matter?
Dude, right now what's happening is like freaking resolution upscaling. People are like going gaga over that now. I'm like, oh my god, you serious? You're complaining about like how yours is like an upscaled 720p to 1080p. Get the fuck out of here. Play your goddamn game.
Go shoot something, dumbass, instead of fucking worrying about how many polygons he's made out of.
Ugh. Yeah.
Fanboys are a pain in the ass.
Yeah, man. But you know what? As long as there's fanboys, there's always going to be the segment. So cheers, cheers.
Mocking them. The more we mock them, the more we mock them. And I hope one of them actually hears one of these for once, because I don't think any of them have heard it. Let's most hope, though. Certainly. Let's hope that they get a little kick in the ass about reality, and that we, you know, there's no room for fanboyism. But that's a whole other rant for another day.
Exactly. So, okay, if you guys have any responses to the Pixel and Polygon Protection Group episode that you listened to today, just please, 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 please post a comment on the comment section for this episode of the Pixel and Polygon Protection Group. The name is going to be, I don't know what the name is going to be, because obviously somebody else is going to determine that. But it's probably going to be on the front page of our website at gamesn.me. Just click on the title or the artwork that accompanies it. You'll get to a page which has a much more detailed explanation as to what the episode is. And subscribe to our podcast. And, you know, put the comments right there, right on the very bottom. And we will read all your responses to anything we talked about in the next episode, like we just did. So, and of course, you can find Magus at youtube.com/MagusX1, MagusX1. And of course, you can find all of our videos here at Games and Me at youtube.com/Games and Me. So, all right, Magus, send us to next week, bro.
With that, guys, Magus out.